Welcome to All Tides with Ann Fisher. The 1966 hit Mustang Sally tells the story of a woman in her sporty Ford Mustang. But the story of women in the automobile goes back as far as the first horseless carriage, and the influence of the car on the history of women is significant. After historian and, author Sue Macy wrote about the new freedoms that bicycles brought to women in the 19th century, she figured the next step was to consider the impact of the automobile on the world of women. That story was more complicated. It's embraced in her new book for young readers entitled Motor Girls, How Women Took the Wheel and Drove Boldly into the 20th Century. Coming up, we'll hear from two contemporary pioneers, a female race car driver now retired and an accomplished female auto mechanic. Joining us now is author Sue Macy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote that the bicycle revolution ended when the age of the motor car began, but women benefited greatly from the two-wheeler, where they were less welcome behind the wheel of an automobile. At the outset, why was that? What happened?
Well, the automobile at the beginning was a very dirty affair as far as mud, dust, rain, all this. Cars were not closed for the first decade or so of their use. So just riding in one was dirty. But if you were driving a gas-powered car, you had to sit in front or stand in front of the car and crank it in order to start it going. And that required a lot of athleticism. Often the crank would recoil and knock you back. There are tales of men who had their arms broken. So people were thought, number one, women might not be up to the physical challenge of starting, especially a gas-powered car. There was also, you know, the whole idea of femininity, and was this in keeping with women looking nice and clean and dainty? And although that's not necessarily how the women felt, that's how a lot of men were concerned about that issue. But in the beginning, there were three types of propulsion for automobiles: gasoline, steam, which was an adaptation of the steam railroad engine, and electricity. And electricity was the way that many people steered women at the beginning. Even Henry Ford, who invented the Model T, which was a gas-powered car, when he bought his wife a car, he bought her an electric, because it was less dirty. It didn't have as long a range between charges, and it also didn't go as fast. So people, if women insisted on cars, on driving cars, a lot of people sort of steered them towards the electric.
And by the way, most women who bought cars or who were able to drive cars and at that point in time, they were upper class women. This was still a luxury, so, you know, maybe someone who was from a different financial class might have thought, well, I don't care, it's going to get me to work faster. But these women, they weren't, most of them, all things being equal, weren't using it for a function. It was a lark.
A lot of them, yes, were doing it as an experiment, a new way to get around, until 1908, when the Model T came into being, and it was the first mass market lower priced automobile. And it took a while to catch on, but once the Model T got a stronghold, people who were not as, you know, the upper class could actually afford to invest in a car. Yeah.
I was surprised by a lot of things in your book about women and the history of women and automobiles. The realm of automobiles seems to have negated, maybe not negated, but sublimated the role of women over time. I was surprised to read that there was a very successful woman selling cars back in the 1920s in Seattle, Lillian Sheridan.
Right, yeah. You know, women, it took a while for them to find a way into this culture. But once they did, I mean, Lillian Sheridan was was a character. She wrote Henry Ford a letter, which when I read it, it almost sounded like a love letter about how much she admired him and she wanted to meet him and could she get an autographed picture. And then as you keep reading, you realize she's not a fan. She's actually one of his dealers. And she started this dealership in actually, she was hired by a dealership to start a women's kind of division, and all her salespeople were women, and they had some very big accounts. They serviced a laundry company that I guess collected people's sheets and cleaned them and then delivered them. So she sold all the cars to this company, and she was very successful and loved Ford until she got married a few years after starting her division. And she married a man who she became a partner in car sales, but they found it more amenable to go and sell Chevrolets. So after all of her professions of love to Henry Ford, you know, she got a better offer from Chevrolet, so she moved on.
Did she keep on representing Chevrolet after that? Because you don't hear about women women run or women manage dealerships very much over time.
Well, she, you know, I did quite a bit of research into her, and she pretty much disappeared from the newspapers. I checked advertisements. I looked for her obituary, and unfortunately, she married a man named Herbert Phillips. He was a lieutenant in the Washington National Guard. And Lillian Phillips, unfortunately, is a pretty common name. I searched obituaries and could not find anybody that fit the demographics that I knew. You know, I knew that she was in Seattle. I knew she had a flower named after her because she was so popular in Seattle. But she didn't do anything that distinguished her in the papers once she moved to Chevrolet. And I actually found the letter that she wrote Ford at the Benson Ford archives in Dearborn, Michigan. So, and Ford had written her up in their company newsletter. I did find some articles on her in Seattle, but they were all while she was still a Ford dealer. So I don't think that she did anything noteworthy beyond selling Chevrolets.
Did anyone ever try to make it illegal for women to drive in the United States?
Well, I don't know so much illegal as frowned upon. there were some strange laws back then in general, but I didn't come up against anything that said women should not drive cars. There were laws, you know, against speeding in Illinois. The most bizarre thing I read was that if they would place police officers at the beginning of a straight road and at the end, and if someone was going too fast, the officers at the end would throw logs in front of the car to stop it, which that's a kind of disastrous way to stop somebody from speeding. But I didn't see any laws saying women should not drive. But there were lots of etiquette books at the time, and there were lots of suggestions on how you should behave in a car. If three ladies entered a motor car, two were married and one was unmarried. The unmarried one was supposed to sit in the back to show deference to the married women, which I thought was interesting. So there were lots of those kinds of behavioral suggestions, but I didn't see laws that said women should not drive under any circumstances.
When the first car came out without a crank, that was a big deal, right?
Yes, and it took a while. I think Cadillac was the first first brand to have a crankless car, and that was even then an expensive car. But yes, it allowed women to, or people, men and women, to drive without that physical effort just at the very beginning. And actually, the reason that the fellow who invented the crankless car did it is that a friend of his, a man, had been cranking and had been assaulted by the crank when it recoiled and ended up dying.
Oh my
because
gosh.
He got some kind of infection, blood infection or something, after breaking, I think it was his arm. So this was, it was not just women who were the victims of the crank, but in the 1910s, there were a series of changes to the automobile that made it a little bit more amenable for women to drive, or for people to accept women as driving, and that included, you know, the gear shift became automated, so it didn't require as much effort. Cars started to be enclosed. It happened more towards the end of the decade, but so driving them didn't mean that you had to change your clothes as soon as you got where you're going, or wear a hood, and all the other. There was a lot of there was actually a fashion, an automobile fashion area that developed because of, you know, because the car was so dirty to drive in. So people wore hoods. They wore dusters, which were the outer coats to protect you. If it was cold, you know, in the winter, people wore special kind of boots, or had blankets that they wore over them, because it was an open vehicle, and not until heaters started being developed, I think it was around the end of the 1910s, did it become comfortable to drive in the cold.
As far as when did it become sort of organized opposition to women, if not driving per se, then taking a lead in automotive businesses? I mean, when did they start to say, well, you better bring your husband by if you're going to get your car fixed, or women start? When did all that start?
I don't think I think it started immediately. I mean, the owners of the cars were usually men. Even, you know, the first women to drive were driving cars that their husbands bought, usually. Mm-hmm. A lot changed around World War One, but before then, you know, the women were often didn't have the disposable income to buy a car, as you said, and were not seen as mechanically astute. Not that men were either, but there were a few exceptions to the rule. And some of these exceptions, these women actually individually campaigned for more respect for women drivers. Joan Newton Cuneo, who you might be discussing later when Lynn St. James comes on, but she was the first really successful American woman race car driver. She drove starting in 1905, but she also wrote often in magazines about women and cars, and what women, you know, why it's important for women to know, to understand the mechanics of an automobile if she's driving. So the individual drivers, racers and others, really did a good job of getting the word out. There were a couple of newspaper writers who were very passionate, female writers who were passionate about automobiles. And, you know, they wrote several articles about the importance of learning not just to turn the key or to crank the car. So they are the ones who really were the standard bearers of women taking control of their own cars.
We are talking about the history of women and the automobile. This is Sue Macy. She's author of a new book. It's entitled Motor Girls, How Women Took the Wheel and Drove Boldly into the 20th Century. Coming up, we're going to hear from a former race car driver. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of women and the automobile. Still with us is historian and author Sue Macy. Her new book for young readers is entitled Motor Girls, How Women Took the Wheel and Drove Boldly into the 20th Century. Sue Macy, thanks again for joining us.
Sure.
Women have been racing automobiles almost since they were first raced, but the practice fell out of favor. Veteran racer and Ohio native Lynn St. James learned that the hard way as she followed her own passion, eventually completing the 7 Indy 500s. Among her many accomplishments, Lynn was the 1992 Indianapolis 500 Rookie of the Year. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Lynn St. James.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You got into racing by accident. How did that happen?
Well, I was really a fan and spectator first. So I remember when I lived in Ohio, I used to go mostly to the drag races. And then I relocated to Florida and found out about sports car racing by going to the 24 hours of Daytona and the 12 hours of Sebring. And it opened up a whole new type of racing to me. But also I found out, you know, that real people drove race cars. They weren't just superhumans like A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti. And people did this as a hobby. And so I was fortunate to be able to pursue that as an amateur, as a hobby, and it became something that I realized I think I was really brought on this earth to do, and really have been doing for 42 years now, as first as an amateur and then as a professional.
I think it was an amateur race that you were just a spectator at, that you were telling somebody, well, you could have done this or that, and they said, well, if you could do better, why don't you try it, and you won the race.
Yeah, that was actually in Ohio at a drag race. Yes.
When that happened, did people go, wow, you're good for a girl?
Well, not really. I don't even think, I mean, I don't know. When that happened, it was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of, you know, it was a really local thing. And my guys, obviously the guys that I was with and drove their car, they were all razzing me. But you know, my mom, when I came home with that trophy, my mom sort of brought that to a screeching halt and said, I didn't send you a girl's school and give you piano lessons to be able to have you doing things like this, even though she taught me how to drive. So I never really pursued it until really much later. And I was, you know, in my 20s. And quite frankly, it was in the 70s. And I remember when Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs. And, mm-hmm. you know, the whole 70s was a different era for women. And I think I got some of the power of my confidence to be able to pursue this from not only playing sports myself as a kid through school because of Title IX, even though I went before Title IX, mm-hmm. But because I went to a girls' school. So I was used to being in a sporting environment, athletic environment. And then when I started racing in the 70s, in 1974, it was kind of, it was a bunch of amateurs. And so it, more importantly, what happened is whenever you did well, they were like, oh, you know, they kind of didn't expect it. And boy, if you didn't do well, it's like, well, you're just a woman driver, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had to really fight wanting to be that woman driver and do things poorly and make sure that I tried to do everything as well as I could.
You know, Sue Macy, yeah. Lynn St. James got her start in 1974 in amateur racing. Women in amateur racing, that goes back pretty far, right?
Sure. I mean, 1905 was when Joan Newton Cuneo started, and over in Europe, there were in the very tragic race of 1903 from Paris to Madrid, Camille Degaste was one of the few women in the race, and she was actually a hero. It was a race where the field was crowded with cars and motorcycles, and it was a cross-country race, so you were on regular unpaved roads, and it was very dry. There was a lot of dust and a lot of spectators, And five of the drivers ended up getting killed, and three of the spectators. And Dugas was one of the leaders, and she ended up stopping to help one of the men and probably saving his life. He was injured, and she helped him. And she came through unscathed, but because of this, all the horrible crashes, people started thinking, well, what if a woman had been killed? The entire sport would be destroyed. So they banned women after in France after that race.
That's an interesting take on it, isn't it, St. James?
Well, it is, and I think that to this day is still a concern. If you know, and women have, there have been women that have been tragically killed in racing today. So, but I think that's always been. It's when I was racing, I think that was always a concern that even my sponsors felt. You know, a certain sort of hesitancy about wanting to do something. But you know, over the years, I've studied a lot more about the history, and of course, I'm delighted. And first of all, I have to congratulate Sue for doing this because that being able to educate people, particularly young people, and realizing that her books are really focused, you know, on that sort of target market of younger people, to make them realize that, hey, you know, this has been going on for centuries and decades, and you just need to go out there and do whatever it is you want to do, and you can do well, and have a sense of history about it. But, you know, when I was reading the history about Joan Newton Cuneo, that was another case where the AAA, who sanctioned all of the races in America, they banned women, even though, you know, there had not been a woman, I don't think, been killed in the United States, but they still felt it was unsafe. And that's one of the reasons why there were less women racing, I think, in this country than there was in Europe, because there were a number of women that were racing in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. We just did a huge event in Phoenix at the Arizona Concours d'Elegance at the Biltmore, where we actually chronicled six amazing women over six decades, of which included the 20s and 30s. You know, we had Elizabeth Unick and Ali Neese, who also raced in this country in the 30s in six races, six different venues, and Anne Cecil Rose Itier and Maria Teresa DeFilippi, Denise McCluggage, and then right up to the 70s with Janet Guthrie. So, and those were just the ones we highlighted. There were certainly others. So I think knowing that there was a rich, you know, a number of women, even though the majority of them, and I was listening to a few minutes before I came on to Sue, that as the ones that actually owned cars and drove cars, that they were usually the wives of or the widows of, and in racing, sometimes the mistresses of men that were enabled them to have the, you know, to have the ability. I mean, to be honest, I wouldn't have probably been able to start racing if it hadn't been that I was married to a guy who also loved racing. And we kind of started it as a husband and wife and started racing together, because you have to have an enabler to be able to do something that is not just unique, but maybe not in your repertoire. You know, I say if you have a bunch of women sitting around at lunch saying, oh, let's build a race car, it's not likely. Where you have a bunch of guys sitting around at lunch who say, you know, we just went to the races, why don't we just build a car, you know? And so a lot of it is that just that culture that enables you to be able to start something and to get involved, and then to have a culture that embraces your abilities and actually invites you, you know, to be there. And women need to be invited. Men just show up.
Right.
That's another culture that sort of prevents more women from being engaged, because there's no other reason that prevents them from doing it.
Lynn St. James, from reading about your career, I don't get the idea that women helped other women in the field as you were coming up through it. Your mentors were men.
True. Very true. But I was fortunate that I got to meet some amazing women athletes through my exposure in racing. But then, you know, I got involved with the Women's Sports Foundation and met Billie Jean King, one of my heroes. And when I saw that if you really sort of reach down and help others and engage other people to help others, that you can really make a difference and make a lot more happen, which is what the Women's Sports Foundation has been doing for 40 years. So that was a great role model for me to be able to do that. So I started my own foundation in the 90s and created a driver development program. And, you know, I met Danica Patrick when she was 14 and started working and helping her and Sarah Fisher and many of the others that have gone on, you know, some to great success and some to just modest success. Mm-hmm. But I really knew that if I couldn't leverage you know, my success and my relationships, my contacts, my knowledge, and be able to benefit others, then what was it all about? You know, I mean, it was just
selfish. Sue Macy?
Yes. Hi. Well, I was just going to pipe in about the 1920s. World War One really did change the way people looked at women driving, because so many women either drove ambulances or on the home front in the United States, they drove in the Women's Motor Corps, which was driving military people around and driving injured people who came from overseas. And so after World War One, the sort of ban on women racing did lift a little bit, because women were seen as actual good drivers at that point.
Yeah, it's interesting the influence of war on women in general when it came to furthering them. You know, Lindsay James, I was surprised at how young racers start now. You said that if you could do it all over again, you would have started earlier. And you started the Complete Driver Academy in the mid-1990s. Why do they have to start so young? They don't even have their driver's license yet.
Well, that's true, but I think that it's, you know, some of this we don't understand either. I don't understand necessarily, but it's the way the sport has moved. Mm. And so when you have young people and when you have parents that are engaged, you know, allow their kids to go go-karting and to do sports and activities that relates to racing and that's actually the path to racing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they can do this at such a young age, then you have kids. I mean, you know, Jeff Gordon is a good example where here's a, you know, superstar NASCAR driver who just retired and in his 40s. But, you know, he was actually, I think it's called emancipated, where he went to the court to be able to race when he was 14, because he wanted to be able to do that because he was required that your parents had to sign it, or it was some law that was preventing him from being able to race. And so, you know, it when these young people that were doing the sport locally and regionally, and the next thing you know, they were really good and they wanted to move up. So that it kind of forced the sport to accept younger people. And that became, I'm going to say, like the floodgates opened. And now we have just a flood of young people that are very good, very experienced. And consequently, it has forced the older people to have to retire earlier, and then they have a long career. And when you have a long career potential, the sponsors and the team owners, it's a business. You know, when you reach the professional level, it turns into a business. And they like the fact that this person is young. It appeals to young buyers, consumers, you know, to their products. And it also gives them a chance to have a longer career with the same sponsor and the same owner. So
In a 1993 Sports Illustrated interview, you said that your entire career has always been who's going to work with the girl driver, and that many male drivers had told you that they couldn't do what you do. Was it hard to find a team?
Oh, yeah. No, it was the determination and the persistence that I had and still have, actually. It's part of my DNA, I guess. But I had to have it, and I had it. Unfortunately, it worked finally in my favor, but there were a lot of my contemporaries, the guys that I raced with at a certain level, at a certain category, who I still stay in touch with and who were as talented, if not more talented, and actually could have gone further in their careers. And they just didn't want to hang in there and work that hard. You know, they kind of reached a peak, I guess, and decided to move on and do something else. And a lot of it was just because they weren't determined enough to hang in there. So,
it's a tough field in any event.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's tougher for a female. People think it's more of an advantage because you are unique and you do stand out, and people do. Sometimes I got more media, maybe, but at the same time, it didn't net me to get a team owner to sign me or a sponsor to sign me. And that's ultimately, you know, to have a career, you got to have a job. And it was harder to get a job, even though whatever I was doing was getting more attention. It just didn't net the result that most people thought it did. So just because I kept showing up and I worked harder and I determined it was like I wouldn't go away. You know, I just won't. I refuse to leave.
You still race. You retired from the professional circuit, but you still race. Any advice for hopefuls? I mean, you know, girls are raised so differently still, you know, despite all the rhetoric out there, they're still raised very differently. As you said, girls aren't going to sit around and talk about putting together a go-kart this weekend. But for that girl, the young woman out there who thinks, gosh, that looks like fun, what do you recommend they do? How does it work?
Well, I mean, first of all, there are now, again, much more accessible go-kart tracks and youth, you know, youth where youth are invited and it's okay. And they're all over the country. And I recommend if it's something that you just think is so cool, try it. And I've dealt with a lot of families where the parents know nothing about it. They're going, what are we doing? You know, because, you know, their child actually gets into it and likes it and now wants to be serious about it. And the parents are clueless about how to go through the process. But from talking to the young people is to say, first of all, don't let anything stop you from trying something. It's legal if it's safe and if it's available, give it a whirl. And if it's something that you really, really, you know, inside you go, wow, this is so cool. As long as you're doing it for your own reason, not because you think somebody else will think it's cool, but because you think it's cool. Sometimes I found some of the gals I worked with, they really were into the mode of, they realized they liked the attention. And so that's not the reason to do it. The reason is because you feel inside this is something that you just are passionate about, you enjoy immensely, and you're willing to work really hard. Because let me tell you, not just being a girl, but the sport is very, very hard physically, mm-hmm. mentally, emotionally, and financially, and technically. And so once you get in it, though, you'll be amazed because most people, even your competitors, will try to help you. I mean, it's almost a family. It's like a traveling circus at the professional level and at the amateur level. It's you know, I've talked to parents whose kids do volleyball and then they do where they actually travel, you know. And so it's very much like that where everybody shows up at the same event and it's almost a family of people that are – it's a community of people who are all gathered to have their kids have fun.
And, like the tennis tour. Like the women's tennis tour. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just not quite as accessible as some of those other sports because you can't do it at school and you can't do it on weekends at the local park, you know, but there are definitely tracks and facilities around and quarter midgets and go-karting and junior dragsters. The NHRA has a great junior dragster program and they focus on safety. They focus on training and they are definitely the doors are open to girls to do this, and so there's no reason why girls shouldn't do it.
Lindsay,
and bring your friends with her. Bring your friends with her. That way they get to do it together.
Lindsay James, thanks so much for joining us this hour. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me. And again, Sue, congratulations on doing this. Oh, I thought it was. I looked into it after I got contacted, and I commend you for it.
Oh, thank you. It means a lot to hear that from you. Thank you.
That's Lynn St. James.
Okay.
She's a former professional race car driver, still out there racing. Coming up, we're going to hear from a longtime auto mechanic who happens to be a woman. She's had her own business here in Columbus for about 34 years now. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of women and the automobile. The car gave women a new lease of personal freedom, not unlike the bicycle, but unlike the bicycle, sexism reared its ugly head and the idea of most women driving was frowned upon by the powers that be. That sexism extended to auto mechanics as well. Still with us is historian and author Sue Macy. Her new book for young readers is entitled Motor Girls, How Women Took the Wheel and Drove Boldly into the 20th Century. Thanks again, Sue Macy, for joining us.
Sure. It's been interesting. Thanks.
You know, even though things have changed a lot when it comes to women and cars and women driving cars, and we just heard from Lynn St. James, retired professional race car driver, women mechanics remain few and far between. Auto mechanic and owner of Alternative Auto Care in Columbus, Chris Cozard. remains a rarity even after 34 years in business. She joins us now. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you are also a longtime adjunct faculty member in the Department of Automotive Technology at Columbus State Community College, and women still make up a small percentage in that program as well. Why do you think?
I think we have not, as an industry, done a very good job of recruiting. I know from when I was in high school in the 70s that the people that got pushed into auto mechanics were guys that were not expected to be able to, quote, cut it in college. Women got sent to cosmetology. And unfortunately, I don't think that has changed too much. When I started 34 years ago, 0.4% of working technicians were women. Now we're up to just a little over 1%, 1.2%.
Wow.
But that's a pretty desperate percentage of women in the industry.
And you make the point, or you've made the point in articles that I've read about you, that this is an incredible opportunity for women who are trying to balance the scales a little bit.
It is on a number of levels. First of all, there's a huge technician shortage. There are not enough skilled technicians in the industry in general, so it's a great field for anybody to consider. But for women in particular, it's an opportunity to have a little bit better access to economic equity without having to invest in four-year degrees, graduate degrees. It's a great wide-open field. It's a very high-tech field. It's a great opportunity for anybody, really, but women in particular, to get out there and get in the workforce and start making money to help support their families.
You know, we talked earlier, Sue Macy, about the woman who was a dealer, a Ford dealer, and then a Chevrolet dealer back in the 20s. But I've known women who are engineers, and I know things are changing sort of, but in the automotive industry, that was a really tough road to hoe if you were a female and the design end of it. And then you write about a woman, the first person to design, invent a windshield wiper was a woman, but nobody ever took her up on it.
Right. She was unable to get it manufactured, but it was Mary Anderson. And she had been visiting New York City and rode on a bus. And the bus driver kept having to reach around the windshield with his hand to wipe the window. And she never forgot that. And she went home to Alabama, I think, and sort of played with the idea. And she came up with a working windshield wiper, and she got it patented, but she was not an inventor. She was actually a property owner of an apartment complex and oversaw that as her job.
Well, she was an inventor. She just never made any money off of it.
Right. This is a one-time invention. But yeah, I mean, she was clearly gifted, and I wish she had been encouraged a little bit more. But yeah, but she did file the patent in 1903. So she was able to, she called it a window cleaning device.
Figures. Chris Kozad, how did you get started?
Well, Ann, I always say it was self-defense. Excuse me. I had an old car when I was in college, no money, and it was always broken. So I tinkered with that. I had a friend who was a mechanic, taught me some of the basics, and I kept that old car running all through college and beyond. So really, then it kind of turned into a hobby. I did it on weekends.
Did you go to college for?
Biology.
Okay.
I used to be a biology teacher.
Okay.
How it turned into a career, I was unemployed at one point. This was in the 80s here in Columbus. And my friends kept calling me and saying, Chris, will you fix my brakes? Or my mom needs an oil change. And I reached a point where I was doing three or four cars a week like that. And I thought, well, okay, I can do this. So I got business cards printed. I had my toolbox in my truck. I worked on the street. Your street, my street, didn't really matter.
Uh-huh, okay.
So, yeah.
Wow.
And I'm thinking that given the computer orientation of late model cars now, it's unlikely that someone could just fall into the business the way you did.
I think that's true. It's a highly technical field, And it's a field that requires really a commitment to lifelong learning. The cars that I worked on 30 years ago when I started are nothing like what we're doing today. So it's constantly reading, staying current, going to classes, learning about the new technology.
And Sue Macy, how did auto mechanics not only get male dominated, but so overly sexist? I mean, who, after all, has not seen those cheesecake calendars proffered by the auto parts manufacturers? How did it get that way?
I don't look at that specifically, but I think that it just, I mean, the automobile was a very male industry from the beginning. And however, in 1915, I think, the YMCA in New York City started inviting women to come take their auto mechanics class. So there were pockets of enlightenment out there, but if you read the literature from that time period, very few men are telling women to learn about your car. Some of them are, but there are a lot of women who were writing. Mrs. A. Sherman Hitchcock, who's one of my favorite journalists from that day, she wrote an article called The Women's Viewpoint of Motoring, and she said, the first requisite is absolute confidence. The next important thing is for her to acquire a thorough acquaintance with the mechanism, a real, not superficial knowledge of the engine, transmission, ignition system, etc. So there were women out there calling others to learn how to take apart your car, how to fix your car. But I think that the dominant culture was just against them. However, the women who drove during World War I did know how to maintain their vehicles.
I mean, there's lots of businesses that cater to men that are not like that. Do you have any insights, Chris, as how it got to be like that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, I've done a lot of research and speaking and presenting about women in non-traditional jobs in general. And so many non-traditional jobs were union-based, electricians, carpenters, and so they had a more structured environment that kind of opened the door for women to begin to get into apprenticeship programs, things like that. The automotive industry doesn't have anything like that. Most shops are small employers, or, you know, even big dealerships are relatively small in the scheme of things. And so it's kind of the consummate old boys club, and it's very difficult to crack into that. I've had lots of employees, women over the years, who tried and found that they, you know, ran into all the things that you think they might run into, the outright sex discrimination, sexual harassment. Or they get the awful work, you know, wind noises and oil leaks, and they don't get any support for furthering their education or learning more about the field. They don't get the mentorship that the young guys did in those days.
Yeah, and that probably extended to people of color as well.
Absolutely. I teach, you know, at Columbus State, and I'm shocked at the demographics of my classes sometimes.
Like in what way?
I've been teaching there 14 years, and certainly I've had women in the program, but never more than one or two in a class of maybe 20 students, and predominantly white. There are a few more young men of color considering automotive as a career, but it's still predominantly young white men.
And the small business operates that way because they have an exclusion from minority hiring incentives, right?
Exactly.
So there's nothing to stop that. Then there's the negative public perception of auto repair shops. We all know that when you find a good one, you glom onto it and you suck up to your auto mechanic, right? Because you want him to be nice to you and treat you fairly. What about that?
That's one of my favorite topics to talk about, because I don't think that there's that much dishonesty in our industry. Is there some? Probably yes. There are some that are out to take advantage of folks. But it's also, to some degree, incompetence. And when I say incompetence, I don't even mean gross incompetence. Mm-hmm. I mean not knowing when to say, this is out of my league, there are times when sending a customer to a dealer is the appropriate thing to do, particularly with complex electronics. But I think the biggest problem with our industry and our horrible reputation is poor communication skills and unmet expectations. And, you know, the other piece of that is that approximately 70% of all automotive-related decisions, whether you what kind of car do you buy, where do you take it for service, how often do you take it for service, those decisions are made predominantly by women, as are most budgetary decisions in households nowadays. And the industry has not adapted to the fact that women think differently than men and that women have different expectations about communication in particular. And I think that's the biggest part of the problem.
I noticed that there's a dealership in town that's now advertising to appeal to women, saying they've taken on, you know, made an effort to mm-hmm. appeal to women more directly.
And I think,
as customers.
Right. And I think that they're kind of getting that 70% statistic and saying, oh, wait, maybe we need to change the way we do things a little bit. But I actually hear it from guys, too, interestingly enough. There are plenty of I have plenty of men customers who don't want to have to go into a shop and pretend that they know what's going on or that they care what's going on. They just want to get their car fixed. Just like anybody else.
Right. A December 2008 article in the Short North Gazette noted that lots of men are more comfortable with your business, too. Now, there's an equal number of men and women as in your customer base, but it started out more women than men, right?
It absolutely did. You know, I've obviously always advertised that way. And in the very beginning, I started in the early 80s. Of course, it was women and the feminist community that were, you know, run into my door. But over the years, that has really changed. And there's a lot of folks who feel like they get those needs met. They get good communication. They get to be treated with respect and have their car treated with respect. All those kinds of things really matter to everybody.
And it just maybe is a suggestion that the feminist community is bigger than just the female gender.
Absolutely.
That men are not, that thing, times are changing, right, Sue Macy?
Absolutely. I mean, I wish I could drive my car from New Jersey to Columbus to get it looked at by you, Chris.
Because
but
it's
I don't know of any female mechanics near me, but maybe I should look a little harder.
Is there a club out there somewhere, Chris Cozad?
You know, there's really not. There should be.
Except there's...
there are a handful of us.
Well, there's an organization that I found that's started a couple of years ago called Women in Automotive. And they actually, I mean, that they are focused on recruiting, retaining, and developing employees in the auto industry. I don't know if that includes you know, mechanics, but I think they have an annual conference. It might be worth checking it out. Maybe you could get them to have more presence for your profession.
Well, at very least, Chris Cozad could probably speak at it.
Absolutely.
She knows about what she speaks.
Yeah.
Sue Macy, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
Sue Macy, she's the author of Motor Girls, How Women Took the Wheel and Drove Boldly into the 20th Century. It's a National Geographic book focused toward a young young audience. Check it out. And also Chris Cozad, auto mechanic and owner of Alternative Auto Care. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, our interns, Sarah Stacey, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.